You're listening to On the Same Page, a podcast from the Jefferson Madison Regional Library.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of On the Same Page. I'm your host, Abby, and today I'm going to be sharing with you a recording of a Skype visit. This was part of the Seaville One Book Initiative, in which the author of The Hate U Give, Angie Thomas, agreed to answer a few questions from community members. So we were very lucky to be able to Skype in and join that, and even more lucky that Ms. Thomas agreed to allow us to record the interview. So we have that coming up in just a little bit, but before we dive into that, we will start with book chat.
I read Lily Listened To Tell Me More by Kelly Corrigan. Kelly Corrigan is a New York Times bestselling memoirist. I have not actually read any of her stuff. I've checked it out and not finished it. Or checked it out and brought it back. She writes about family stories, like her childhood and her family, and this is an adulthood writing about her now, and I heard about it. I was listening to a podcast by Jen Hatmaker, and she was talking to this author. I think they actually did a Facebook Live, and then they recorded it for a podcast, and this author is just so engaging and so irreverent and so funny, and I was like, okay, I want to try out one of her books. And so I got Tell Me More. And in the audio, she's reading it, so it's like she's telling you her story, which is great. And it's nonfiction, and it's in stories, and it's about the things she's learning to say. So she's learning to be a better listener with her kids instead of the fixer parent that she wants to be by being like, oh, you had a hard day at school. Tell me more. Not being like, yeah, Jennifer's a real jerk. She shouldn't be mean to you. Like, tell me more. Like, what happened? And just through a whole conversation, asking people to tell them more is one of the things. And she goes through other things. And one is to say, I was wrong, not I'm sorry. I mean, I'm sorry as well. But, like, the important thing isn't to be like, oh, I'm sorry. The important thing is to be like, I was incorrect. I made a mistake. I was wrong. And she tells these things with, like, irreverent humor and sometimes foul language and through stories. So you see her yell at her husband and feel bad about it and take the wrong tack with her kids or her parents, you know, and recover. And it was really great. It's hard to be a grown up and we're all still learning, I think is the point. But yeah, it was funny and it was fun. And I've told other people to read it.
It's good. Not a bummer.
Not a bummer. Not a bummer. It also tells, like, an ongoing story of grief of losing her father, who was quite old, and also a young friend who was quite young, and the juxtaposition. Being friends in adulthood and moving forward through tragedy, and Corrigan herself is a recovering? Not alcoholic.
No,
cancer. She had breast cancer.
In remission?
Yeah. She's survived.
Breast cancer survivor.
Yeah. She's a breast cancer survivor. So she's not, you know, none of it is foreign to her. But she came out that way, and not everyone does. So, yeah, it's a good memoir and stories, and she's a fun author, and I recommend her.
Cool.
Yeah.
The other book that I read was Severance by Ling Ma. And this was...
Are these part of your reading challenge?
No, this took place in New York.
Oh, okay.
Sort of. Partially. It's great for fans of Station 11.
Oh!
There is... Yeah.
I'm a fan of Station 11.
So there's this almost worldwide pandemic. It starts in China and then comes over in... Right, in boxes and goods to the U.S. And spreads throughout North and South America. I think it makes its way into throughout Asia, into most of Europe and Africa. Like, Scandinavia is fine because it's cold. It's interesting. But it's the main character works for a publisher. She works in Bibles.
Mm-hmm.
And what they do is they are basically contract with cheap production facilities in China, mm-hmm. and people who want special, like, small run books. And for her, it's Bibles. Other departments in her publisher print other things.
So, you know, the samples they're getting are probably infected. And it's a fungus that's infecting people, and it's, like, part zombie story.
Okay.
The people who come down with it are called the fevered. They're not doing anything nefarious. What ends up happening is the sicker and sicker that you get, and, like, as your body starts to die, your, you know, reptile brain is still working, but rather than seeking food and eating human flesh, like in other zombie stories, you're just completing the same routines that you do every day. So it's sort of like, great. So it's an interesting take on the like apocalyptic kind of zombie thing. And also just like, why do you do what you do?
Right.
So like people, there's somebody in, I can't remember what the clothing store is, but she sees a fever worker who's still going even long after like the store has closed down because there's nobody left in the city really to do anything, that's still folding sweaters endlessly. Like, she's stuck in a loop. She runs into some other uninfected people and she sort of joins up with their group, and that's also got a very Station 11 feel.
Mm-hmm.
It's the sort of like, are you better off in this group
or
are
you not? Is the protection of the group worth threats? Do you wonder what your loops are?
A little bit, yeah. I was just thinking, like, oh, God.
What would I be doing?
Great. Would you even notice if you were fevered? Would you just, are you doing the same thing every day? I think was sort of the point, like, yeah. So I liked it. It was great. I really enjoyed it a lot.
Was it as literary? Station 11's kind of...
Right. So
considered.
Right. It's like, what, the apocalyptic story for the people who don't like reading.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a good character story, but it has an apocalypse in it.
Yes.
That sounds good. Would I like it?
Maybe. Did you like Station 11?
Yes. It was kind of boring.
There are a lot of characters that you just hate, but it's because you're supposed to hate them.
Mm.
Maybe not a lot, but there are some.
I don't know. Is it short?
Under 300?
It's pretty good.
Okay, next up I've got a recording of a Skype interview with Angie Thomas. She's the author of the award-winning young adult novel, The Hate U Give. This was the focus of the Seaville One Buck Initiative, which served high schoolers in the local area, and I will link to the Seaville One Buck website if you would like to know more about that. This interview was also a part of that initiative, and it was a Skype interview, and because it was a three-way call with the Jefferson School African American Heritage Center hosting the interview, some of the audio quality is not perfect, particularly the questions being asked by community members, as well as a wonderful introduction and moderation provided by local author Mark Boston. So I've had to cut most of that content, and you'll hear almost exclusively Angie Thomas speaking. That means that there are going to be some strange pauses and odd transitions, because you won't hear the questions being asked. But Angie does a wonderful job of sort of explaining the question that she's answering as she answers. So I'm sure that it will still be a worthwhile listen. So we'll go ahead and jump right into that.
Thank you all so much.
Can you hear us?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes. Welcome to Charleston. We're so glad to have you.
Thank you for having me.
We know that you are a busy person with all these accolades, and we just have a few questions for you, if you don't mind.
Okay.
I'd like to, do you have something that you want to share with us before we begin our questioning?
Yeah, sure. First of all, thank you all so much for coming out tonight to listen to me via Skype, you know. I know it's a little different than me being there, so I appreciate you coming to, like, basically watch me on a giant TV. So that means a lot that you took the time out to do that. So I hope that one day I can be there with you all. But I actually want to commend you as a community for the work that you're all doing in response to the racism and bigotry that found itself in your town and the tragedy that found itself in your town. I think that Charlottesville has made itself the example for what the rest of America needs to follow in the face of bigotry and racism. The work that you all are doing to ensure not only that this is not repeated, but to ensure that those with such racist views no longer feel welcome in your town It's phenomenal. I feel like you all deserve a hand clap. It's just for Mississippi and something in Mississippi and the things that we're dealing with right now with our own leadership to see what your community has decided to do and stand up and say enough is enough. It gives me hope for the rest of the country. So from the bottom of my heart, thank you for setting the example, and I hope that the rest of America at some point follows it. I was just reading an article the other day about there's like they call it a guerrilla news network there in town that's reporting things on from all of the city council meetings to just all of the activity that could happen there, things that could happen there. There's a news network working to prevent it from happening there. Like, that is incredible. So I'm going to have to curse, but Charlottesville, you all are badasses. But when I think about what made me write The Hate U Give, you know, a lot of people talk to me about it, and they're like, why would you tackle something so political, specifically for your first novel, and then even more so for a young adult novel, because this is a book written for teenagers. And for me, it's never been political, it's always been personal. And I think that for more of us, we have to take politics more personally by the day. I look at one of my heroes, Rosa Parks. A lot of people don't know that on that day in 1955, when she decided to not give up her seat, one thing that made her decide to stay in her seat was Emmett Till. She had taken his death so personally that she decided enough was enough. And so often our heroes take things that are often made political and make them personal, because they affect so many of us personally. So when I wrote The Hate U Give, for me, it was about writing for those young men who see themselves in Trayvon Martin, who, when someone calls Trayvon Martin a thug, it feels as if they're being called a thug. When someone calls Tamir Rice, this 12-year-old baby, a thug, it feels as if they're being called one. I wrote it for them because they take it personally, and I need for everybody else to take this personally as well. So I'm a big proponent of making it political personal. I'm a big proponent of empathy. I'm a big proponent of the idea that empathy is far more powerful than sympathy. I hope that more of us feel things from beyond ourselves. I hope that more of us decide to care about people and lives beyond ourselves. The only way we're going to change the world is to start by changing the world around us. And to change the world around us, we got to care about things beyond ourselves. So for me, that's why I wrote The Hate U Give. That's why I did it. And if it's a political book to some people, that's okay. But for me, it's still a personal account. But I'm happy to know, and I'm honored to know, that you all have decided to read this book and that you've taken to it as in the way that you have, and that even so many of you in Charlottesville have decided that this is the book for you. That is amazing to me. I never would have guessed that anyone beyond those kids in my neighborhood would have read this book. And apparently a lot of people have read this book, so I was really surprised. But thank you again, and I am so looking forward to answering your questions and getting into this discussion, because through Skype session, I hate talking to people. I prefer talking with people, because, you know, there's this whole element of technology making it seem very impersonal. So to make it a little more personal, since you're talking about making it a political person, let me talk with you instead of to you. So for these questions and answers, I do have a couple of rules. One, and I usually have to tell this to the kids, but I don't think I have to necessarily stress this to you all, but I'm going to put this out there. So, number one, there's no such thing as a dumb question. Sometimes questions just aren't well thought out, and that's okay. Don't be afraid to ask the questions. Now, I usually have to really tell the kids this one, but two, if you laugh, smirk at somebody's question, because if you think it's dumb, I'm going to give you a clarion pemmican. All right? And trust me, I took lessons from the best, my mother. I could give one heck of a mama glitter. And three, I often have to ask kids that questions don't get too personal. I'm often asked by little kids especially, how much money do you make? enough, can I tell you what my facts? So, that's it. Let's get right into this. I'm excited.
And this is Mark. I hope you don't mind. I'm going to open up a couple of questions that I have to ask myself.
All right.
My first question is, I understand now what inspired you to write the book. When did you first realize that you wanted to be a writer?
You know, I have been telling stories for as long as I can remember. Like, if I brought my mom in here, she's in the room. If I brought my mom in, she would probably take up this entire section just telling you all about the storyteller I was as a little girl. If I didn't like the way that a book ended when she read it to me at bedtime, story time, if I didn't like the way a book ended, I would be like, no, mommy, it should have gone like this. And so, like at around 4 years old, I caught myself rewriting Green Eggs and Ham because I didn't like that he gave in and liked Green Eggs and Ham. So my person was like, I still don't like Green Eggs and Ham. I still don't like them, Sam I Am. So I thought I was better than Dr. Seuss, but I didn't think that writing, as I got older, I wasn't sure that it was something I could do because I wasn't used to seeing writers from where I was from who looked like me. You know, I'm from Mississippi. We have a rich literary history, but you have like Eudora Welty, William Faulkner, Richard Wright, and all of them were either old, white, or dead. I was neither of those things. And I was like, is it possible for somebody like me to even be an author? So I didn't think it was possible. It wasn't until I got to college that I really realized it was something that could be done, that a writing career was accessible. So it's really been there my entire life, but it took meeting writers and seeing writers like me that we realized that it was possible. So when we say representation is important, that's one reason why, because as long as kids aren't seeing people doing things who look like them, they're not going to think that it's possible for them to do it. So I'm happy if I can give any kids in Mississippi a little more representation and fuel their dreams a little more and help them see that it's possible too for them to even do this. You know, code switching is such an interesting thing to me because often at times it feels like a survival tactic when you're a black person in America. You know, the fact of the matter is I can't enter certain spaces being my authentic self because I will either be perceived as being too much or not enough. Simply because of the color of my skin. Even if I went in corporate America, there are some places if I went with my hair like this, it would become an issue of office politics and I would be expected to change in order to make others more comfortable. And that's the unfortunate society we live in. That's the world we live in where blackness and black people are not nearly as accepted as black culture. And what I mean by that is look at someone like Elvis. Elvis back in the day, his entire style was taken from black people, and they loved it. People loved it, but black artists could not get into the same clubs that he did, nor were they afforded the same opportunities that he was given, despite the fact he was using their very style successfully. So there's always been this thing in America where blackness is cool when it makes others comfortable. And when it's not, when others are uncomfortable by it, suddenly it's an issue. And then, too, there's this whole idea of the way that people speak being used to determine their intelligence. Fact is, I can sit here and say, ain't gonna, ain't gonna. That does not take away from the fact that I have a 3.98 GPA. It just means I'm country. The way you present yourself is not okay. I want us to get to the point where code switching is not necessary. I would love that, but I don't know if that's ever going to happen in my lifetime, if I'm perfectly honest. I'm code switching to a degree right now, you know? But it's just, it becomes a natural part of us in some degree. And then you wonder when you're doing it, does this mean I'm not authentic? Does it mean I'm not my authentic self? And then there's the flip side. Yeah, and then there's the flip side of if we're code switching most of the time, unfortunately, sometimes when we go back into our own communities, we're accused of acting white. But what I tell kids all the time is there's no such thing as talking black. There's no such thing as talking white. You just talk. And however that is, that's you. And own that. There's nothing wrong with however you talk. So I want us to get to the point where black people are just as accepted as black culture. And when I say black people are just as accepted, I mean 1,000%, however we are. And I hope that we can get away from this idea that code switching has to be done. A good example of it is this recent episode of Black-ish. I love Black-ish. They had this episode where, and Andre, the main character, was at work. And he got a new coworker, this white guy, and this guy comes in and he puts his feet up on the table and he's like, "Yo, man, what's up? You know, how you doing, my man? You know, you good, homie? You good?" And he's talking to the boss like that. And Andre's like, "If I came in here in 5 seconds, I'd be fired." But that was although it was comedic, it was an example of how so often the idea of blackness is far more accepted than black people. So I hope that at some point black people can be even more accepted than the idea of blackness, and at some point, code switching will no longer be a survival tactic, but an option. Ooh, I have to almost ask, okay, is there anyone there working in publishing before I go into this one? It's a constant struggle and it's a constant battle, and it's frustrating because the numbers are showing year by year. Not only are there fewer books featuring kids of color, but there are fewer authors writing those books who are people of color. And it kind of goes back to the whole idea, like I was saying a few minutes ago, at times it feels like blackness and then two other ethnicities, our cultures are far more accepted than we are. You know, I look at Native Americans and how so often there's so much cultural appropriation when it comes to their culture, but they're not accepted by our country nearly as much as they should be. They're not afforded the same benefits as nearly as much as so many of us are. You know, they're often treated as second-class citizens in a country that is theirs, you know? So why is it that their culture is far more accepted than them? And it kind of goes into publishing as well. Why is it that stories about black kids are far more accepted by white writers? We have a problem with that. I'm a strong believer that you will get the most authentic stories from what are called own voice books. Own voice books are books by marginalized people who share the same marginalization as their character. Now, when I say that, that does not mean that someone cannot write about a character who is unlike themselves. You can write whatever you want to write, but I would say if you think that it's something you want to do, you need to put in the work, but also accept the fact that if you are writing this story, you are taking a seat away from the table for someone who is has that marginalization, who may have wanted to tell a similar story. It's kind of like how recently there were some discussions regarding the movie The Green Book. The movie was written by a white gentleman, and the Green Book is an actual thing that African Americans had to use in the country when it came to road trips or successfully make it from point A to point B during segregation. And the movie apparently doesn't actually reference the actual Green Book nearly enough, not for a movie that's supposed to be called Green Book. But here's the thing now, here's what people are saying. So the fact that we have this movie called The Green Book, if a black scriptwriter or black director decided, hey, I want to tell the story about the actual Green Book during the segregation period. Oh, wait, I can't, because now Hollywood is going to say that's been done already. So, but my point is, if you're going to write a character who is marginalized, different table. And also, it goes back to the whole idea of representation. We need authors of color so that kids can know that they exist, and so that kids can know this is something that they can do, and so that kids can know authors are writing stories for them. In children's literature, we say there's an academic by the name of Dr. Ruby Sims Bishop who says that books are either mirrors, windows, or sliding glass doors. And all three are important. So I want these kids to not only get mirrors and windows and sliding glass doors through books, I want them to get them through the authors themselves. So I'm hoping that if nothing else, maybe the success of the Hating Gift will open the door for more authors of color, more marginalized authors, to get some seats at the table so that publishing looks more like our world actually looks. Simple as that.
Yeah.
you know, through this character, Chris, I wanted to show what a good ally he is in hopes that he will later become a good co-conspirator. Chris is not woke. Let's just be clear about this. Chris is not woke. Chris is, like, drowsy by the end of the book. But before the book starts, Chris is, like, in REM sleep. He's not woke at all. So he gets drowsy, but I hope that at some point he's going to become fully alert. But through this young man and through their relationship specifically, I wanted to show these two kids who recognize that they, first of all, he comes to realize that they are from two very different worlds, and he comes to see her more so as being black. I'm a huge advocate of just saying no to colorblindness. People say they're colorblind all the time, and we have to start saying no to colorblindness. Because here's the thing, when you tell me I don't see color, what you're telling me too is that I don't see the things that affect you as a person of color. I need you to see them. So just say no to colorblindness. Let's make that a t-shirt. Just say no to colorblindness. There is nothing wrong with seeing color. The problems come when, if you see me as being inferior to you once you do see my color. That's when the problems come. There's nothing wrong with celebrating our differences. There's nothing wrong with recognizing that. There's nothing wrong with you seeing my blackness and saying it's beautiful. There's nothing wrong with me seeing your whiteness and saying it's beautiful. The problems come when you make someone either inferior or superior. That's it. Here. Okay. So just say no to colorblindness. So, through Chris, he comes to no longer be colorblind. Because in the movie, they put a line that I wish I would have put in the book, but Star said, if you don't see my blackness, you don't see me. And that is powerful because she needs him to see what she experiences as a young black woman. And she needs him to be aware of the things they're going to experience as an interracial couple. So, through Chris and through Star's relationship, I wanted to show these two kids who come to that understanding at least a little bit more, and also who, despite the differences between them, still have love. I'm corny in the sense that I believe that love conquers all. And I'm like, if these two kids in this racially charged situation from two very different worlds can still at the end say, I love you, I felt that was powerful. So, I'm being romantic in that sense, you know? And through Chris, though, I did want to show this very privileged young man who comes to the realization that the world has been given to him in a totally different way, and he has to be aware of lives beyond his own. And I think my thinking was, if there's hope for a guy like Chris, there's hope for a lot of people. He comes from a very radical family, a very progressive family. And as mayor, he is bringing those same progressive ideas to the city of Jackson, and he's actually creating wonderful changes. So through him, I'm seeing proof that it is possible to change things from the inside looking out. The thing about politics, though, is always it feels as if too often politicians aren't authentic, and they seem to at times lose a bit of their authenticity in order to appeal to the larger machine. Sometimes it feels like it becomes a thing of, I just want to be right, I don't care if I'm wrong, versus doing the goodwill of the people. But I think it is possible to do it from the inside. We're seeing more progressives run for offices and men than we've seen in a long time. And I have so much hope that eventually we're going to see change now. Do I think that it's going to happen overnight? People of color and progressive politicians getting into these spaces, do I think that the long-term change is going to happen overnight? No, it's going to take time. design, because we're talking about a system that has been that was designed and that has been in place for hundreds of years. It's going to take a long time to fix it. But I have to believe that we have to get it there and actually fix it. So, yes, I hope that you do become Supreme Court Justice. If we find it's going to take that, and it's going to take people willing to say that I'm not going to go in there and sell out. I'm going to stick to what I believe in, and I'm going to fight for what I believe in when I get in there. It's going to take that, and I have to believe that we can change the system. We have to at some point, so that our kids and grandkids aren't looking back at us and saying, why didn't you try to change it from the inside? It's going to take both outside and inside work to do. So don't let her make you feel like you're a sellout for wanting to do that. Now, I forgot your other question. Through Chris and through Star's relationship with Chris, I wanted to show also, this struggle still, too, that sometimes interracial couples deal with. It's not all roses all the time still. We still have issues. It still sometimes makes people uncomfortable. It really did just come down to me wanting to show these two kids who shared so much love for each other that they were willing to, well, Chris specifically was willing to listen and learn because he cared so much about this girl. I wanted to show through them what it really means, through their relationship, what it means to begin to be a good ally. In hopes that later on, when Chris and Star are older, she's climbing up the pole and he wraps himself around her. I hope that it inspires some other young Chris's out there to wrap themselves around some poles. I'm definitely dealing with it in my own life, considering what was just elected to Congress from Mississippi. I think everyone's heard about that. And it was interesting because I was so angry the night of that I angrily tweeted about the whole thing. And I guess I hadn't gotten the memo that people watch what I tweet, because my mom woke me up like at 6 a.m. the next morning, and she's like, girl, they put your tweets on the news. And I have a lot of feelings about a lot of this. We're in an interesting time right now where it feels like the wrong voices are the loudest voices and the wrong people are winning. And it's frustrating because you wonder, who is it that's around me that supports this on the low? And when is it that they're going to stop supporting it and supporting it quietly and start supporting it loudly? Who is it that I know who voted for this senator who said she'd be front row at a public hearing? Who do I know that did that? It makes you start wondering. It makes you almost paranoid about the people around you. And then it makes you wonder who in that room right there supports someone like that. How can you justify that? You wonder, what is it that makes people decide that some things are okay and some things can be overlooked? The answer, white supremacy. I know that seems crazy, but that is the answer, because the thing is, that's at the root of it all. And it has to be addressed and it has to be called out, you can outwardly say you're for this, this, and this, but if you're going in the voting booth and voting against those very things, surprise, you're still supporting white supremacy. Simple as that. So I think the good thing is more people are being bold about it. And I know that's a weird thing to say, but now I know where more people stand on things. Now I have a better idea of where even some of my current political leaders stand on things. Like, for instance, I live here in Mississippi. Now I know how the governor really feels about people like me in this state. And I'm glad that I now know how the governor feels about people like me here in this state. That means I'm probably moving from this state because I refuse to let my tax dollars go into his pocket. That's a personal decision I've made. But it has to happen, though. So often, people of color are often made to feel as if racism is ours to fix, and it's not. I need all the white people in there. I need you to fix racism. I need you to make racists afraid again. I need you to erase racism. How do you do it? You have those uncomfortable conversations at your dinner table on holidays. How do you do it? You call out even microaggressions when you hear them from your colleagues and your friends. You all, a lot of us have that one friend, that one family member who makes those jokes that make us uncomfortable, and we're like, oh, they don't really mean it. Yes, they do mean it, and I need you to call it out, because guess what? That later manifests into them going into voting booths and being like, simple stuff like that make racists uncomfortable. And I know it's uncomfortable to call those things out, but it is very uncomfortable to me as a woman of color in this country when white supremacists are elected to office. So I need you to think of my discomfort and make yourself a little bit uncomfortable and call that stuff out. I promise you it will make a huge difference. So, yes, I have a lot of feelings on that. People of color to fix racism in this country. I need white people to fix it. Call it out. Change the world around you, and I promise you will find yourself changing the world. Yeah, you know, that wasn't in the book. And when I first read it in the script, I kind of had a gut reaction of, wait, what? You know, because of the character of Carlos, and Carlos was based on in my actual life, and I wondered, and it made me wonder too, with my real life Carlos, how would he answer that? For me though, the scene was important, not so much, for me it was more, what was so important about it wasn't so much Carlos even explaining the whole procedure to Star. Most important thing to me in that scene was Carlos admitting that he too had bias. I think all of us have a little bit of it inside of us. And Carlos had to admit it in that moment. And I think that was a huge thing for him. And I think that's a huge thing for us to come to terms with. And for Pink's admitting that to Star, that scene, it shows Star that her uncle was imperfect, her uncle was flawed, and that this is something deeper than maybe she even realized. That scene was never like about the procedure, because the unfortunate fact is we often hear that side. We often hear that story. We never hear the victim side in these cases. We often hear about why the officer did it from the officer's perspective. So that wasn't new. But for Carlos to come and admit that, I probably would have reacted differently if it was a white guy or a black guy. That's him admitting that, wow, I have a little bias inside of myself. And Star realizing that this is something that if someone like her uncle can say that, then who knows who else can say it. So we have an issue that's even bigger than something she may even have an ability to fix. So it was about Carlos admitting that, and I hope that when viewers watched it, they took a second and reflected on themselves and wondered, how would they have reacted in a situation like that? And would they have reacted differently? And if they would have reacted differently with a white guy or some black guy, I mean, they have some bias in themselves.
And how much input did you have with the song at the end?
You know, I was consulted a whole lot. I was not a decision maker, but I was consulted a lot. The screenwriters and I had a lot of conversations. We had two screenwriters on the script. Audrey Wells, who unfortunately passed right before the movie came out, and Tina Mayward, a young black screenwriter from here in Mississippi. And between the three of us, we had so many conversations about these characters and everything. And also the director, George Tillman Jr., kept me involved the entire process. I mean, I still get calls from George now about stuff, but we'll be out, you know. They're doing their Oscars campaign to hopefully get some nominations. And so while he's doing these question and answer panels and stuff like that, before he goes on, he'll call me and ask me about stuff. So he still keeps me involved. But I was very happy with how it turned out, because the fact was they respected not just the source material, but the source of the source material. I spent like 6 weeks on set, and I was consulted on small things and large things even throughout that time. So Star's bedroom, initially they had pictures of Chris on the wall, and I went in and I saw that, and I was like, this would be a problem. And they were like, why? I said, well, Maverick doesn't know about Chris, and Maverick is not a knock-knock man. Come in, Dad. It wouldn't have affected the movie, but I knew with my readers caught that they would tweet to me and be like, Angie, why don't you let them do that? So they took the pictures down. So yeah, I did get a lot of different, I did get some say in things. Although I wasn't the final decision maker, my opinions were greatly valued.
I have a 9-year-old son, and he has 2 questions for you as an author.
Well, those are great questions. And I have to say, you're doing right if you're nervous to get your mom to ask, but that's what I used to do too, so you're on the right path, buddy. You are, because that shows me already that you're conscious of what you say and how you say things, and I think as a writer, we're always conscious of that. So you are a writer, buddy. I promise you are. For me, it took about 6 months to write the first draft of The Hate U Give, and a year and a half altogether though, once I did all the edits. Because the big thing about writing, the biggest part of writing is actually revising. A lot of people don't talk about that, but it is. The biggest part of writing is editing and revising. And the other question was, how did I get the idea for the book? Or how do I get my ideas? I take inspiration from a lot of different things when it comes to ideas for books. So far, I take a lot of inspiration from my personal life. With The Hate U Give, I took inspiration from my own college experience of living in 2 different worlds. I lived in a mostly black poor neighborhood, and I went to a mostly white upper class private school here in Mississippi. So I lived in 2 different worlds and thought I had to be 2 different people. So I took that from myself. And my second book, which comes out in February 5th, I took inspiration from my life again. It's about a 16-year-old girl who wanted to be a rapper. And guess what? At 16, I wanted to be a rapper. And it's about how her life is turned upside down after, 1, her mom unexpectedly loses her job, and 2, a song she makes goes viral for all the wrong reasons. And I took inspiration from my life for both of those things because my big traumatic moment as a teenager was when my mom lost her job. And now, as an author, I deal with censorship attempts from people who are uncomfortable by The Hate U Give. So I really took inspiration from that. Sometimes stories come from the oddest places. I've just started working on my 3rd book, and I never would have thought I would be writing this book, but I'm writing it. It's going to be a prequel about Maverick as a teenager. And I never thought that I was going to do that. I had no intention of returning to the world of The Hate U Give. Like, the character kept speaking to me in his own way, and I meet people who say that they love Maverick. You know, it's funny, I do book signings, and a lot of times the moms love to tell me, oh my God, I love Maverick. They got like a Maverick fan club. And I'm like, for me, it was hearing the way people talked about him and the way that they were inspired by this character that made me decide to look at his journey as a teenager. How did he go from an anger-filled young man to the character we see later in The Hate U Give? So sometimes best inspiration comes from just listening to the world around you. I promise you, there are so many stories right around you that deserve to be told, and you can be the very person that should tell them.
One more question, but real quick, Amy, I just want to listen here. I had heard that the police shooting in South Carolina banned your book. Real quick, but like, kind of one more question. Is this true?
Well, they didn't ban the book. What they did was there was a school district who had it on their summer reading list, and the police union spoke out against it. It was my book and another book called All American Boys, and the police union hadn't even read the book, and they automatically assumed that it was going to create anti-police sentiment into students, and so they spoke out against it. They went to the media and all of these things, which was disheartening because I wish they would talk to all of the police unions and the police forces around the country who have decided to read the book together, or who have had book clubs with schools so they could discuss the book, or the police unions and the police forces who have now taken groups of kids to see the movie and have question and answer sessions afterwards to build better community relationships. So I got a lot of feelings on that, and they'll see how I feel. feel in my second book, because I'm really getting this one. To the young man who wants to be a writer, if you ever want to get revenge on people, you have the best job. I've had a lot of... I have a powerful story about that scene. We did a screening of the movie here in Mississippi with, like, a lot of my close family and friends and the general public. And there was one gentleman sitting behind me, an older white gentleman, who was watching the movie. And he sobbed throughout the whole movie. Afterwards, someone who knew him came to me and they said, they told me that when he was a little boy, his father was the mayor of the town next to the town where Emmett Till was killed. And he remembered, as a little boy, his dad laughing and joking about how they covered up that case and got away with it. And he used to laugh and joke with his dad about it. And he said that while watching the movie, you realize and seeing that first, that opening scene, from that opening scene alone, seeing the conversation that Maverick had to have with his children, and then thinking about how his father once joked to him about the death of Emmett Till, struck him hard because he realized how different life is and how different it still is for so many people in this country who look like Maverick and who look like a star, and how different it is for them than it is for people who look like him. So that, I hope that more people...
I'm sorry about that. That feed kind of went a little crazy, so I'm not going to ask you to repeat anything you just said. I think we got the gist of it, right?
Well, I was saying that when Tamir Rice was killed, the police officers claimed that they thought he was a grown man. Often, black kids are perceived as being older than they actually are. And as a result, so often, black parents have to have conversations with their children that make them grow up even sooner than they should. They have to have these very adult discussions with them. So if your 9, 10, 11, 12-year-old only has to experience this through a book, consider yourself blessed. That's what I always tell parents. Because there are black parents who have to tell their 7-year-olds how to act if they're confronted by police officers.
Thank you. Honestly, thank you very much on behalf of everyone here in the audience. It's so wonderful. We really, truly are honored and we appreciate you joining us this evening.
Thank you, and continue the good hard work there in Charlottesville. I firmly believe that you all can set the standard of what this country can be. So keep fighting the good fight.
Okay, a big thank you to Angie Thomas for allowing us to record that interview, and a big thank you to the Jefferson School and African American Heritage Center for hosting and allowing us to Skype in. We really enjoyed getting to hear from Angie Thomas and are grateful that she allowed us to record it and share it with you here. A big thank you, as always, to the Friends of the Library, without whose generous support this podcast would not be possible. If you'd like to learn more or become a friend, you can do so at jmrlfriends.org, and there will be a link in the show notes to their website. That's all that I have for you today, and I will be back in the new year. But until then, thank you for tuning in, and we're glad to be on the same page.